mixture of both. But the result, chaos, bodes ill for the nation still reeling from the near strangulation of the country's constitution by a self-appointed president determined to hold on to power. Several weeks ago, at the height of the state of emergency decree, a welder in Rawalpindi told a reporter, quote, "If I stood for election here, I would win more seats than Musharraf," unquote. In an August 07 poll of Pakistanis, President General Musharraf scored a miserable 38% approval rating, and that was before the emergency decrees. Musharraf's low rating was positively astronomical compared to President Bush's anemic 9%. According to the Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit group Terror Free Tomorrow, 19% of Pakistanis held a favorable view of the U.S. Oh, yeah, Osama bin Laden, he scores a 46% approval rating. Figures like these send chills down the spines of U.S. policymakers when they consider Pakistan's prospects for democracy. They were thus hoping for a smooth transition from Musharraf to Bhutto, who, as a Western-educated woman with impeccable liberal credentials, would have kept the door open to the U.S. on friendly terms. That option is now gone. The forecast for the U.S. is more instability on the horizon. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. Special thanks today to Hassan Banura from KPFK in LA. I'm Aura Bogado.
Evaporation. Mornings fresh, oxygen clean.
Good evening. You are tuned in to 90.7 KBOO FM, your community radio station. This is Michael Anderson.
And Jerry Thiemeyer. Welcome.
Welcome to Hole in the Bucket. This is KBOO's show on housing, homelessness, and poverty. We have a big show tonight. Several different pretty dense subjects we're going to cover. We're going to talk about it's tax season coming up, and particularly for low-income people, that means there's some options for assistance to make sure that they're getting the benefits they deserve. We're going to talk about that. We're going to hear about the subprime lending crisis in Portland and talk about what we can do about it and what it's going to look like over the next couple of years. And then we're going to conclude tonight with talking to Jim Tierney about the aftermath of the flood devastation in Northwest Oregon. But to open up our show, Jay.
We'd like to welcome first Natalie Mitchell, who will be talking to us about financial coaching for the basically the working poor, people on the margin who need assistance in avoiding unscrupulous lenders. If they're provided information, which is hard to get, then they can find assistance with tax credits and loans to avoid the predatory folks. Welcome, Natalie.
Thank you. Thank you, Jay. I'm a program assistant with Multnomah County Commission on Children, Families, and Communities. I'm working on the Family Economic Security Project. And during the implementation of the project, we did some focus groups. And what we found through these focus groups with about 26 different individuals that consider themselves low to moderate income working individuals and families, that they really want access to good financial education. That usable and realistic, accessible financial education just doesn't seem to be available right now.
You mean it's not available from the spam on the
no.
internet?
No. You know, there's a lot of information about wealth management, but not a lot about management when you've got modest income, modest means. So our goal was to provide a tool for resources that are either low cost or free, that are right here in the Portland metropolitan area, specifically Multnomah County, that can be found online, can be found through nonprofits and social service agencies. We even found banks and credit unions that have very nice financial coaching opportunities and opportunities to become a banking member or a credit union member. And for folks that are outside of the banking mainstream world that, you know, like you said, do become prey to other forms of financial institutions.
Which credit unions were you thinking of specifically?
I found some great content through Point West, through Unitas, Advantis, Oregonians Credit Union. They're very open to capturing that audience that for a number of years was left with the gap of going to the payday loans and the cash advance and, you know, living paycheck to paycheck and constantly using money orders and no direct deposit. They didn't have the benefits that a lot of people just take for granted of having direct deposit and paying your bills online and not having any fees charged to you for each and every transaction that you tried to do to handle your money. And there's goes along with the myth that low-income people either can't or won't learn how to manage money, when in reality, low-income folks, they're probably better at managing money on a modest means than some people that have a higher income. So we're trying to put this tool out there to remind people that, you know, it's really nice four steps, you know, just make money, don't spend it all, pay off your debts, and start saving as soon as you can. And hopefully the content in this financial education handbook will remind them that there's ways to get your foot in the door with banks and credit unions and get your free credit report and the importance of a credit score so that they can start to build a banking relationship and stay away from the cash advances and the payday loans.
So how is it going to work from taking it from the research and information you're pulling together to getting it to people who would need this, and I'm going to guess might otherwise not be super connected to systems that have information that's like this?
What we're doing is we're constructing an actual handbook. It's in the review process right now. And as soon as it's complete, it's going to have nice graphics, some nice quotes from our consumers, and we're going to put it in all the social service agencies that we can get on board, which I'm assuming most social service agencies are going to be very positive about this. It'll be on Chair Wheeler's website. It'll be accessed through 211 Info. We're going to put it at all the free tax assistance centers. We're pretty much going to put this handbook throughout all of Multnomah County.
And will there be any kind of training offered? Or if people have questions, will there be some stuff like where people can follow up?
My name and my contact information will always be on the handbook as long as the handbook is updated, and we'll constantly update information through 211 Info. It'll be on the Multnomah County Commission's website. And this is the first year that it'll be available, and it really is a pilot project. It's one of the very first tools that's going to be available to low to moderate income working families in Multnomah County to get them into the mainstream banking world.
Sounds good. Do you work with letting people who are qualified know that they qualify for things like EITC? Is that the sort of thing that you're going to be providing in this brochure?
Through the Family Economic Security Project, we can go out to employers and do a whole like a brown bag lunch and talk with a human resources director or a program director and get right down, you know, sit at the table with them, with employees to talk about their options, their opportunities, and possibly their eligibility for advanced earned income tax credit or just regular earned income tax credit.
What sort of businesses do you anticipate going to visit to give this kind of spiel?
A lot of the nonprofits, a lot of the social service agencies. Actually, we're going to be able to go to, you know, City of Portland, Multnomah County, Portland Public Schools. If there's a large body of employers, you know, and when we're talking about advanced earned income tax credit, there's a lot of people in there that fall into that category that may not actually realize it. So
you'd be going to Portland Impact, Human Solutions.
Definitely.
What are some others that you'd be going to?
Head Start. We're definitely going to be going to Head Start. Like I said, Portland Public Schools. Anything that considers itself a nonprofit and has already partnered with us in the past, we're going to be going there. Neighborhood House. I think you mentioned Portland Impact.
Right. Mm-hmm. Friendly House.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Terrific. Mm-hmm. Well, with that, I'd like to launch into a conversation with our second guest for this first segment, Jim Harper, who's with Cash Oregon. It's tax season. What do you have in store for to help people who are again, the modest means folks who need help with avoiding having to pay a huge amount for tax preparation.
Thanks, Jay. My name is Jim Harper. I'm the executive director for Cash Oregon, and we partner with AARP Tax Aid to do free electronics tax preparation and for low-income working families and for seniors, and then we file those electronically. So we have 50 locations in the Tri-County area here, and we have found, as Natalie had said earlier, that probably 30% of the people who are entitled to some kind of a earned income tax credit or some kind of a tax credit don't take advantage of that. They don't file, so they don't collect what's out there. Now, if you look at earned income tax credit, for example, a person who qualifies, makes less than $39,000 a year with two qualifying children, can receive up to $4,700 just for the earned income tax credit. Then there's a child tax credit that, in addition to that. There's the Oregon Earned Income Tax Credit in addition to that. And then there's a dependent care working family tax. So there are four different tax credits that are out there that people sometimes just don't take advantage of. And so our role is to reach out. And in the Tri-County, we did over 11,000 returns last year. We're on track to do a lot more than that this year. And it's all free. We have phone numbers. Again, 211 is a huge support. And a person can call there to find out, well, where's the closest tax site, free tax site for me to call or get involved with. We have appointment sites, and then we have drop-in sites, like the Lloyd Center, for example, is a drop-in site that's open on Wednesdays, Saturdays and Sundays from 10 until 4 in the afternoon. And a person come, we have 10 tax preparers in there working to help people get their taxes taken care of. And it's a great service that we provide and that people can take advantage of.
Just a couple clarification, because you just gave out a bunch of really great information.
Okay.
For one, for our listeners, a lot of people might know about 211, but just in case you don't, 211 is similar to 411 or 911.
That's correct.
It's a public service number that anyone can call to find out more information in the metro area, from everything ranging to tax assistance to this to emergency rent assistance, utility assistance, an assortment of things. So just for context. Then on the Lloyd Center, I've been following Cash Oregon for years. Where do you guys sit up in the Lloyd Center? I went looking for 1 year and I couldn't find you.
Yeah, we're up in the Lloyd Center. We're on the third floor where the food court is. And if you go up to the third floor and you go down the wing, the business wing toward Nordstrom, we're right down there across the aisle from Apollo College. And it's a great place to be. It's open. We have actually two suites up there. We have one that does the taxes, where we have our tax preparers, and then we have another suite that has the intake, where we have a place where people can bring their children, and the children can watch TV and play games, and while their parents fill out the paperwork that come in and get their taxes taken care of. We have a number of those sites. We have a lot of sites in senior centers. We have a lot of sites in the community centers scattered throughout the Tri-County area. So it's a great service. AARP has been doing this for a number of years, and Earned Income Tax Credit has been around for, I think, 75 years. It's been out there available to people to take advantage of.
How do you reach people who are not English-speaking? English is not their first language.
Yeah, that's a great question. We have, as you call 211, or if you go to, let me give you a couple of websites that I think are actually three. If you go to cashoregon.org, or you go to aarp.org/taxaid, or you go to IRS website, then it'll ask you, it'll have a prompt for free taxes. And it'll tell you where all the tax sites, and it'll give you a prompt. It'll ask you for your zip code. And when you put the zip code in, then it'll tell you where the tax sites are, the closest one to you. Also, if you go to the IRS, there's a whole list of them. And it'll tell you which ones are appointment sites, which one are drop-in sites, which one have Spanish speakers that are available, which ones to work with I-10s to help people who don't have Social Securities that need to get an I-10 taken care of in there. So we try to have as much of that information available. We're out currently recruiting for tax preparers, and we're also recruiting for people who can interpret, who speak different languages, who can help us as greeters. And if someone comes in as a Spanish speaker or a Russian speaker or whatever language, then we can have someone that can help them go through that process.
So let's focus on that for a second, because one of the things in the KABU listening audience is I bet we have a bunch of people who would be very capable and adept at being tax preparers. If they wanted to do that, who would they contact and how would they get involved?
The best place to get involved right now is to call 503-243-7765. Again, that's 503-243-7765, and that's a place they can leave their name and phone number, and then we'll get back to them and we'll ask them what are they interested in volunteering to do. If they want to be a tax preparer, you have to study for that and take a test. You have to pass an IRS open book test so that we know that people are qualified, because we want to do quality returns. And every single return we do for people when they come in has a second set of eyes, so it has a quality reviewer. So every return is seen by at least two people before it's transmitted.
Wow.
And they get their money back when we electronically transmit it in 7 to 14 days if we put it in their bank account or their checking account, or have it mailed directly to their house.
You know, and I think particularly, I mean, it's tax season, so it's the season we got to do it. But, you know, just last show we had a couple people on here who were really struggling with utility bills. And it yes. seems to me this could be the money that would help carry you through the winter.
Right, exactly, with the cuts to things like LEAP, the Low-Income Energy Assistance Program, and all these federal programs. These things are absolutely necessary.
Well, just an example, I worked with a young mother with a child here a couple of weeks ago doing 2006 returns, and she got back $3,700 that she wasn't expecting to get back. Well, and that's all, the taxes already been paid on that. So here's a check for $3,700. The average return on an earned income tax credit is around $1,500 in Multnomah County right now that a person will get back.
Wow.
That's amazing. So I want to ask, say a person has this money coming back, then they can access the Family Economic Security brochure.
Right. Yeah, we definitely want people to be getting those resources back and implementing a savings plan right away.
That's our goal, too, is to give them a point and put them in touch with someone who can help them with whatever needs that they perceive that would help them financially.
Well, is the tax preparation located also at the same locations that the brochure would be located? For example, Portland Impact and Human Solutions?
We would have the brochures at our sites that we could give to people.
The sites aren't the same.
The sites wouldn't be the same.
Well, I hate to say that we have about a minute left of this discussion, because I think that this is extremely valuable information. We often talk about not having money, and you guys are talking about how to build wealth. Is there any closing stuff that you want to leave our audience with, any numbers you want to repeat?
Well, once the financial education handbook is complete, if anybody can remember 2-on-1 info, that's the fastest way. We'll definitely have it listed on there.
That's literally 2-on-1-info.
INFO.org. Mm-hmm. Or you can do the phone call, 2-on-1.
Yeah, just dial 2-on-1.
2-on-1. And I would agree with that. I think Multnomah County is doing a terrific job in the programs that they're putting together. And this is the largest anti-poverty program that the federal government has to help low-income working families. So, again, I would say if you want to volunteer, and we have a tremendous need, 503-243-7765.
Thank you very much, both of you, for your work, and thank you for taking time to come into KABU. We're going to take a brief break, and then we're going to come back with Matt Wallace, who's going to talk about the subprime lending crisis. Thank you. Hi, we're back with Hole in the Bucket, and now we are joined by Matt Wallace from Osberg, who's going to talk about the subprime lending crisis.
Welcome, Matt. And how did we get here? How did we get to this point of crisis?
Sure. Well, thanks for having me. That's a great question. How did we get here? And I think before just delving into that, you know, it's good to sort of get an idea of where we are and where this is. I mean, most of us by now are familiar with the subprime mortgage crisis, the mortgage meltdown, if you will. And what's happened is that just record numbers of people, just thousands in Oregon and millions nationwide, will be facing foreclosure. And that obviously has the very worst effects on the people that are experiencing, you know, that experience, having, you know, their homes basically taken back and taken away and losing that most valuable asset. But also, you know, there's just a huge ripple effect out on the economy at large. I mean, there's a lot of analysts now predicting that we could see a full blown recession as a result of the mortgage meltdown and the collapse of the system.
The big question I have, I read the national coverage daily, and there is this crisis going on nationwide, but what we read locally is that it hasn't really hit here. We seem to be it's like exceptionalism, that
right.
We're somehow immune, and I know that's an illusion.
Well, yeah, we all know that Oregon is exceptional, but unfortunately, we're still seeing very significant problems when it comes to the subprime mortgage crisis. It is true that, you know, we're not being hit as badly as some other states, and that's great news, and we should all be very pleased with that, but we are facing some very significant problems. Projections are that, you know, almost 20% of the subprime or high-cost mortgages that were originated in 2005 and 2006 could end up in foreclosure. In addition to that, I mean, there's over 15,000 families in Oregon that will be experiencing sharply increasing monthly payments, over the next year or so, as the introductory rates on their mortgages reset to much higher monthly payments. Which I think, you know, sort of brings us back to the question of how did we get here? And there are a lot of factors. There's actually a lot of sort of chicken and egg questions that you can ask when it comes to the mortgage meltdown. But, some of the factors that are key are we've just seen incredibly lax lending standards just proliferate over the last few years. And along with that, we've seen a rise in a lot of mortgage lending practices that are pretty suspect. And part of that has been motivated by a sort of change in the mortgage marketplace from how it used to be. And to illustrate it, you know, to think about it, back maybe 30, 40 years ago, if you wanted to buy a house, you'd go to your bank and say, you know, I'd like a mortgage, you know, I'd like to buy a house, and they'd evaluate your ability and your income and your assets and figure out what you could qualify for. And everyone in the picture had a pretty big incentive to make sure that you didn't default and foreclose and fall behind on your loan payments, because ultimately, you know, it generally doesn't do the bank a lot of good if you can't make your payments either and end up in foreclosure. But unfortunately, that's just not the way that it works anymore. What's happened more and more recently is that the people that originate the mortgages, even the lenders oftentimes that initially make the mortgage deal, don't hold on to those mortgages, and they get sort of chopped up into financial packages that get sent out and sold on various secondary markets. And, you know, one result of that is that there's just been a huge decrease in the standards for lending. The people that make the loans no longer have the ultimate incentive to make sure that they don't go bad, because they end up turning them around and selling them right away. And so that's part of the problem as well. But where the rubber hits the road and where it really affects working families is in the mortgage lending practices, and that's what is really the heart of the problem.
One of the things that I attended a training that you did on this, and I have some background myself. But one of the things that strikes me is oftentimes this isn't people in their initial mortgage they get for a house, but a refinancing where, you know, reduce your payment or get some extra cash. Talk about that and how people have been seduced into these bad loan products.
Sure, yeah, definitely a clear minority of sort of subprime loans have been granted to people that are actually trying to buy a house for the first time. And then really quickly, I don't know if it might be helpful to actually just talk about what subprime loans are,
sure.
Which is that sometimes we jump right in without sort of clarifying the terms. But subprime loans are typically just high-cost loans. They're loans that cost more than a regular typical loan, and they're generally given to people that have a shakier credit history or presumed to be a higher credit risk. And that's why this issue has been impacting so many people, especially unfortunately on the low income side of the income scale. So those are the subprime loans. And yeah, absolutely, most of subprime loans and most of the loans that we're seeing problems with are not loans for first time homeowners. They're loans that are refinances of existing mortgages. And anyone that that owns a home, even many renters are probably very familiar with the barrage of junk mail that you get every day, saying let's free up money for home improvements, free up money for vacation, refinance your loan, interest rates so low, and then there's always the asterisk. But absolutely, most folks are not trying to become a homeowner for the first time. And in fact, the subprime mortgage crisis, the mortgage meltdown, has really led to a net loss in home ownership. If you look at the people that have actually used these loans to get into houses for the first time. And are going to lose them compared to how many people are either refinancing or looking to become another second stage homeowner that have lost their homes because of these practices.
The research that you've done, do you get a sense locally of any kind of who the people are who are facing increasing home foreclosures? Is there a demographic breakdown that you have discovered?
Yeah, interestingly, it's definitely a problem that affects low-income people, disproportionately. Interestingly, a lot of these lending practices and these exotic and sometimes dangerous loan products have been marketed to people that that don't necessarily have shaky credit histories. So as the phenomenon move forward, more and more people that have pretty good credit scores ended up in these really bad loan situations, but yeah, definitely, disproportionately, it's something that's happened to low-income people, and demographically, across race and ethnicity, there's also pretty clear differences, both in Oregon and nationwide.
Now, would you say, and again, I don't know how much information you have, and I know it's deeper than just facts and numbers, but so we know that people of color are disproportionately low-income for all sorts of reasons we don't have time to get into today. Are we seeing this subprime hit communities of color at a rate that's even greater than their proportional poverty? Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I think that's fair to say, actually. The city of Baltimore, I just saw today, actually filed a lawsuit in that state based on predatory lending, that's directed towards low-income people and especially people of color. So definitely, I think nationwide, that's a trend that a lot of people have pointed out. And it's something that I don't expect is unfortunately terribly different here.
Yeah, or coincidental.
Yeah, for that matter.
The people of color have been, or low-income people have been subject to predatory lending that was hopefully addressed by the past legislation in the past session. And now there's this new thing dealing with subprime mortgage lending. And what are you pushing to do in the special session? What kind of legislative repair would you like to see put in place?
Well, we definitely have a great opportunity to move forward with reform to mortgage lending practices in February. So we're very excited to be working on that. And definitely we were excited to be a big part of payday lending reform that moved forward last session and protecting people from just those 1,600% interest rate short-term loans that were so prevalent. But yeah, definitely there's a lot that needs to be done. There's a lot that we can do that we're working to do in February. And again, where the rubber meets the road for consumers is just the kinds of lending practices that are currently legal and that we need to do something about. One interesting thing that might be surprising is that oftentimes if you were to hire a broker to navigate a financial transaction for you, you'd think that they would have some obligation to act in your interest. And when it comes to mortgage lending, that's unfortunately not the case. In fact, mortgage brokers often have a financial incentive to steer you into a loan that is far worse than one that you would qualify for. And that's something they call the yield spread premium, where the lender, the one that's actually entity that's actually providing the money will sort of offer a kickback to the broker who's making the deal, and the amount of that money in the broker's pocket will depend on how much more expensive the loan that they secure is compared to the loan that the lender would have accepted based on risk. So we definitely just need to make sure that, you know, that brokers and are acting in the interest of their clients. And then there's also, as you mentioned, you know, many of the or the vast majority of these loans are refinances. And there's another practice that's become pretty prevalent, which they refer to as loan flipping. And that means that there's just someone will have a home loan and they'll get offers over and over again to refinance with, you know, tantalizing offers like free up some money, lower your interest rate, what have you. They'll sometimes refinance their loans five or six times. But unfortunately, there's just no net benefit at all to those loans. The loans are no better, sometimes worse than the loans they already had. And what happens instead is they just have thousands of dollars in equity from their home stripped out by the fees. And so that's definitely another issue that needs to be addressed. And then probably the, you know, another big one is simply just evaluating a borrower's ability to repay, which is a big part of how we got into this mess, and making sure that, you know, you don't tell someone that they can afford a $500,000 home mm-hmm. when they can't. You know, consumers often will go ask a broker, you know, what can I get? You know, here's what I've got. Here's what I'd like. You know, what can I get? And if a broker or a lender tells a consumer that they can afford a $500,000 home, consumers unfortunately often have a reason to believe that that's true. It may be a surprise, but they, you know, have no reason to doubt that. So we need to really evaluate borrowers' ability to repay the loans, and not just on the introductory rates, which is another hallmark of a lot of the loans that we're seeing default now.
The teaser rates.
The teaser rates, exactly. You know, a great many of these loans that we're seeing so many problems with have these low introductory rates and payments that last for maybe 2 years. Sometimes 3 years or 5 years, and then all of a sudden, you know, ratchet up. And when I say there's 15,000 families about to experience painful resets on their monthly mortgage payments, those are the folks that I'm talking about.
Right. I know that you you gave me an excellent website to check out to get a sort of a broader context. The Center for Responsible Lending has a great website. That's Center for Responsible Lending. And I'm wondering if, Osberg, if your website has, for example, the possible legislative initiatives that you'd like to push in the special session.
Sure. Funny you should mention, I'm just putting the finishing touches on the mortgage lending section of our website today. So that should be up and running within the next day or so. So for more information about the legislative effort, absolutely, you know, you should check out www.osberg.org. And you can find the section on our website under consumer protection. For the mortgage lending issue, we'll definitely also have opportunities to, you know, contact us. We're certainly asking people who have personal stories about the mortgage lending crisis and who have experienced some of these predatory lending and abusive lending practices to share those stories if they're willing. And it's definitely something that the more people that talk about what they've experienced, the better chances we'll have of really motivating change, you know, in February.
You know, one of the things that we talk a lot about at this show is that if you want to change stuff like this, especially when the people on the other side of the battle, as it were, are the banking industry, the people really need to speak up. So talk a little bit about if people at home are listening and they're thinking about calling their representative or senator, what should they say?
They should say that now is the time to really move forward on mortgage lending reform. We need to stop the mortgage meltdown, and to do that, we really need to address the issues of mortgage lending practices. So we need to make sure that brokers and lenders have, you know, have some duties under the law to their clients. We need to make sure that that lenders and brokers are evaluating a borrower's ability to repay. And we need to get rid of just completely unreasonable fees and penalties. For example, one thing that we've seen a lot of is prepayment penalties, where borrowers or where someone will get a mortgage, and if they want to get out of it 2 or 3 years later, once the rate resets or they can find a better deal or their credit has gotten better, there'll actually be a penalty on their mortgage for paying it early. And so that's another thing that we need to do. But, yeah, but for the quick phone call, for the quick message, if you're calling your legislator, you know, we need to address mortgage lending practices in February, and we need to pass reform to really move this issue forward.
And if they want to get involved with you, who should they call?
They should call Osberg. The phone number is 503-231-4181 for our office. And you can check out our website. You can get my contact information there at osberg.org.
Thank you very much, Matt. This is really important work. Thank you for taking this down to Salem.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Change of a nickel, ain't got no bounce in my shoes, ain't got no fancy to tickle.
Welcome back. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial. This is your community radio, and this is Hole in the Bucket. This is the third segment of tonight's show, and welcome to the studio, Jim Tierney. Hello, Jim.
Hi, Michael.
Jim is a friend and a colleague of mine. He also lives in Vernonia, and it was about a month ago that a torrent of rain came down in unexpected and really horrific fashion, flooding the valley around Vernonia, and many of the people in the community are still staggered by the devastation. So tonight, Jim is going to share with us a little bit of what is going on out there in Northwest Oregon right now and what the path to recovery looks like. So I know this is a very personal and a very huge, complex issue, but just I think a lot of our listeners probably were following when the news cameras were out there and there was front page coverage as the flood happened and people first realized the impact. What's it like now in Vernonia?
Well, Michael, sorry. I'm actually going to speak about Vernonia and the entire county in Columbia County because there were the extensive damage. About 93% of the damage went in the Nahanlin Valley, which runs from Washington County up through Clatsop County and around Fishhawk Lake, which I know you know where that is. But there was also mudslides and flooding in Clatskanie and in St. Helens. There were 90 homes that were flooded in St. Helens, and I'm not really sure about the number in Clatskanie. We're still working on some of that data, but it was much less. But we did have those fantastic mudslides that you saw, I'm sure. It showed up in the Boston Globe for one. At any rate, we've been trying to gather accurate data on what's there, and there's in FEMA's database in Columbia County, there are 728 victims, flood families or homes that were flooded or businesses, and in our database, we have about 640. So there's some that we're missing, but there's a lot of folks that are hurting. About 93% of that's in the Nahanlin Valley, which is around Vernonia's kind of in the middle part of that valley. And what we're seeing in terms of the recovery is that it's really variable. There are still every day that we're open in the Flood Recovery Center in what was once the Vernonia Learning Center has been sort of taken over by the Vernonia schools. I don't know if you saw when you were in Vernonia that all three of our schools were devastated by the flood, and we're still busing our kids to Scappoose some of them are actually in the Vernonia Learning Center, one room. They're having two classes in one room, and in the back room is where our Flood Recovery Center is. And we're working the whole county. And what we're seeing is that every day we have somebody walk in there that has not had any recovery yet. It's getting much less common for us to see that. We're seeing some of the first houses getting fully rebuilt. I talked with a man in the store just 2 days ago, and the tape was drying on his house. He's got to be the furthest along of anybody I've met. Some of the delays are that it takes quite a while, depending on the specific circumstances of the house, for the water to dry out. You have to wait for the wood within the house to get down to less than 19% moisture before you can put sheetrock and insulation and such back. So we're just at the place where we're starting to get demands for sheetrock. And the recovery center that we put together, we have in the initial rushes, we went through, and I know you were out there working with us, we went through at least 20,000 hours of volunteer labor that came out and worked. And the amount of donations that we had in clothing and furniture and money and was just phenomenal. In fact, we were overwhelmed by it. We certainly had a warehousing problem. We had a lot of trouble getting efficient use of our volunteers. We did the very best we could, but it was really difficult to focus that many people that quickly. We did, however, get most people recovered. Right now we're moving into a different transition. We're transitioning into a new phase, and that is that instead of generally working neighborhoods and helping people muck out their homes and get the debris hauled away, we're beginning to target those people for whom recovery is not going to go really well. For people who had flood insurance and who had personal resources, the recovery, although it might be a difficult financial event, it was a possibility. For others, it just is overwhelming. I heard a story from one of my employees just recently that there was a family sitting around the wood stove in their house just smoking cigarettes, and they didn't know what to do. And they're depressed. There's a lot of people with PTSD that were flooded more than once. And even now we're seeing people that are reacting whenever it rains because they're worried it's going to flood again. So we have some mental health issues that are slowing things down. But essentially, there's a lot of folks for whom money is going to be the major problem. And our flood recovery effort is gradually beginning to focus more on that than it is on the furniture and clothing and the immediate needs and getting things cleaned up. That's because FEMA, people tend to think of FEMA is going to ride in on a white horse and save them, and that's not a very realistic picture. First of all, people in a flood zone are expected to have flood insurance. FEMA essentially sees itself as backing up both flood insurance and the Small Business Administration. So if you're flooded, the expectation is that you'd have flood insurance. If you did not, or even if you did, you might go to SBA either to get the money to solve your problem or to backfill what the insurance didn't cover. Only if those two didn't work does FEMA step up and start talking about grants. And FEMA has a lifetime for the house of $28,800 that they'll put into everything that they'll do for a house. Well, in this particular flood, we had about a 95% overlap over the ones that were flooded in 1996. And since we have about a 25% insured rate, you can imagine that we have an awful lot of gaps, and FEMA paid out a lot of money on houses last time and are not going to pay that much, apparently, this time. Our flood recovery team that we have, about 20 core volunteers who have been working tirelessly, I just can't say enough about them, since the flood, are still trying to get their arms around FEMA's rules and how to negotiate that and understand SBA, understand what they can do. And we're beginning to have bids float in where people can see what their financial gaps are. So that's really going to be our focus, is helping people get their homes recovered and get through that process. And we've had help from some folks that would really be worth talking about. International medical teams stepped right up and gave us $25,000 to give out as emergency grants, which we've given out at this point to people to help fill the gaps between FEMA, FEMA would come in and help folks out with some personal recovery money. And Oregon Housing Community Services put $50,000 immediately into homeless services through Community Action Team, my employer. And we were able to help a lot of people with that. So there's been people step up to the plate. We've had a group called Tzu Chi, which is a Buddhist foundation, has brought in. I don't know that because they did this. I don't know the total amount of resources they brought in, but it was pretty substantial, and I'm sure plus of $20,000 that they gave out to people in Vernonia. And we're beginning to see the missionary groups come in to help with repairs, and others like I met yesterday with a representative of the Seabees. They want to come in and bring a bunch of folks in to help. Christian Aid Ministries were in Vernonia in 1996 and stayed, I think, for 18 months. At one point, they had a lot of people in the field working there, and they're rebuilding a house for themselves to use. So they're setting up a permanent base there for the flood event. Compassion First is another Christian Aid group that is helping us and has been, I mean, I think they've been out to 10 or 11 homes now. And these are folks that are very comprehensive. And so part of our strategy, in addition to working with FEMA and flood insurance and so on, is to try and raise the money and materials to help those groups do their job. So if they're bringing skilled labor into town, what they need from us is sometimes a place to live and the building materials and the cash necessary for permits and other things to do their job. But the last time, I think we actually rebuilt from scratch five houses that were totally destroyed.
One of the things that struck me, and as you noted, my parents have a house up by Fishhawk Lake, so this is an area that I'm pretty familiar with. There's a number of people who live in the roads outside Vernonia, a little bit in Vernonia too for sure, but the homes that they were living in were manufactured homes. When water hits those manufactured homes, it makes them very it sometimes completely trashes them. What are those folks doing? I know that there's probably countless stories, but
I'm not really certain that this statement is correct, but what I'm hearing from everyone that I speak to about that exact issue, and I got to tell you, Michael, I've been sort of subsumed with the organizing and management piece of what I've been doing for the last 40 days. But what I'm hearing is that most of those are going to be a total destroy job, that there's not a way to repair them when the floors start swelling. I know at least a couple of manufactured homes that are double wide types that are going to have the insulation repaired, and the people feel they're going to be okay. But they're often a different sort of structure, and they're harder to repair and more easily damaged. So we're expecting an awful lot of those to be destroyed. I'm not sure what will happen from that. Part of the answer to that comes down to what the building codes require. Any jurisdiction that has national flood insurance is required to have adopted an ordinance that requires that any home that is more than 50% damaged the owner has three choices: that you have to either destroy it, lift it, elevate it, they call it, or move it. So that the idea there is to not have FEMA and others have to suffer those losses again. That local jurisdictions have a little control over how that's interpreted, but generally those are the rules. And with a manufactured home, I mean, how do you cite one of those if we now look at saying, well, we have to cite them above a certain level in the flood, we may raise our levels. That can be a real problem for them, and none of that stuff is sorted out at this point.
I'm curious, after the 96 flood, if there was an adjustment and they were raised, can you talk about why these people were flooded again? I mean, why it was insufficient?
Well, first of all, we tried to raise as many houses as we could find resources to do after 96. And in the end, we only managed to raise 16 of them. And those did pretty well, if not were perfectly well. So that was a very successful program. I know FEMA's come out and looked at those 16 as sort of a model and said this worked for us. But of the hundreds and hundreds that were flooded, the most were not considered substantially damaged, and the owner simply repaired them and went back to what they were doing. So, that's the short answer. Things that were built new, in Vernonia in particular, we passed an ordinance that you had to build a foot above the 96 flood. And in fact, as Michael knows, I am in my real life a developer of affordable housing and community facilities for a nonprofit. We built a Head Start Center to those standards and an apartment project to those standards, both of which were flooded. So in that area, the flood appears to have been about 3 feet higher than a 96 flood. The way the Corps of Engineers calculates this stuff, they say, what are the chances in a given area get flooded? And according to the maps that we still have, that are the best information we have, that area, the area that's in the base flood elevation has a 1% chance or more of getting flooded every year. What happened in 96 was considered a 500-year event or a 0.2% chance that flood would have happened. And then this flood was actually higher than that in some areas. So personally, I think the data is bad. Mm-hmm. I also think there are other factors at work. And so I think it would behoove us all to be pretty cautious about how we rebuild. But it's political jurisdictions that have to make the choices to require certain building elevations. That has economic consequences on the people who own land, and over time, sometimes that they sort of wear them down.
I'm curious that I'm wondering about pavement of the floodplain itself. In other words, paved surfacing and large. Large retailers creating sort of flat paved space, the drain off resulting from that. Has there been a response to this most recent event, to call for less development or more control of that kind of?
If you look at the maps, in Vernonia is a small town, and it's actually the biggest community in the area where most of the flooding happened by far. I think the number of homes that got developed in Vernonia between 1996 and 2007 was relatively small, a handful, maybe 20 or 30, 40 homes maybe, many of which were not anywhere near the floodplain. So I don't think paving is really an issue.
I was thinking of economic development, not residential.
And there's not really been, to my knowledge, not been a lot of that. In our valley. There are other kinds of things that may have affected it. There are certainly some people who are suggesting that logging is a factor and we do clear cuts and that water runs down the slope quickly. That kind of talk will get you a lot of conversation in our coffee shops in Vernonia. But it's more complicated than that. I know that one area of near Vernonia that got flooded particularly badly, appears to have been damaged in part because a landowner let some of his land grow up in reproduction. I mean, he let it grow up in trees, which are normally what's there. And the trees were in the floodplain, and the floodplain, they acted as kind of a dam and really slowed the water down through that area, probably made it easier on other parts downstream. But made it much worse on parts upstream. So it's a really a complicated little dance, and I think that an engineer would be very challenged to calculate why the floods happen where they do and when they do. In Vernonia and the Mahan Valley, I'm going to have to suggest that it probably had very little to do with development per se, except that there are sections where in the town of Vernonia itself, I think there are things where we've developed over the years, not since 96 mainly, but we've developed over the years. Our sewer lagoons are in an almost direct line of where the water would flow if you think about a flood. And the lagoons are actually above the base flood elevation. They're in the 500-year floodplain. So they sort of act as a big rock in the stream from my point of view. So there's a lot of things that people don't see the consequences when you do something. It just seems like the obvious thing to do. And some of this stuff has got millions of dollars behind it. The schools in Vernonia are if we're going to move those, the kinds of numbers we're talking about are 20, 30, maybe $40 million.
Wow.
And we have 2,500 people, maybe another 1,500 in the rural areas to pay for that. So those are very challenging things. The city of Vernonia is going to move its sewer lagoons. The last number I heard for that was about $46 million.
Wow.
So it's a real problem. And I don't know there's a solution to some of the things.
In other words, you can't have economic development without taking the risks.
Right. Well, our economic development is limited in the rural places. It's like Vernonia. It's very hard to do economic development. Mainly, it's tourism, and I mean the Banks Vernonia Linear Trail, and some shops downtown, many of which did not get flooded, and a new skills park that was on an area that did get flooded, are the kinds of economic development we do.
Do you have any big box development there with the big parking spaces?
No,
it's
nothing,
all small retail. And,
yeah.
And there probably hasn't been anything larger than a driveway paved in Vernonia in 10 years. I mean, it's just not that big a place.
Yeah, it's a small town with steep slopes all around it, just functioning like a bathtub wall.
I want to ask you about the work that you do. I wasn't familiar with that. Michael is, but the affordable housing that you
I work for a nonprofit that is an anti-poverty agency serving Clatsop, Tillamook, and Columbia counties, and I'm with the community development portion of that nonprofit, and so we do we have done some infrastructure projects. For example, the water plant in Vernonia is one of our projects. We've done housing, which is built affordable housing and rehabbed affordable housing. We have a housing rehabilitation program we do for homeowners and landlords. We do weatherization. We do community facilities like Head Starts and senior centers, things of that sort. So that's my part of the department does those things. We also have a housing center, which does homeownership education and matching up, and a self-help housing program, which is a sweat equity program that we've developed for homeownership. So those are the kinds of things that we do within our department. The agency itself does many other things, Head Start, homeless programs, veterans programs, senior programs. We have a daycare latchkey program and a daycare referral program and so on. We do a lot of different things.
And with this crisis, it impacted some of the projects that you'd worked on in Vernonia.
Yes.
Do you want to talk a little bit about that? And then, unfortunately, I'm looking a little bit at the clock. I want to hear about that, especially, and then if you want to move into, for people who are listening tonight, if there's something that they could do, a way that they could get involved.
Well, our housing project and the we're just receiving the bids and the settlements from our insurance companies because we had flood insurance on those projects. And I can tell you, if homeowners are in the same experience we're in, they're going to be in a little bit of pain. I'm not sure how we're going to find the gaps there between the two projects. We probably have a gap that's around $300,000 we have to fill with the Head Start and the housing project. And we're working for find ways to do that. Sometimes nonprofits can do things a little cheaper, and we're examining that. In terms of how people can help, there are again, we really need assistance in the form of cash, building materials, and skilled labor. Typically, we use the cash to kind of grease the jobs that I was talking about earlier, and the labor are the people that we would target out and send out to help individuals, and the building materials are what we use to keep people going. If people would like to help, our main unmet needs number is 503-791-9421. If you have a donation...
Do you want to repeat it one more time?
Sure. 503-791-9421. If you have a donation, or if you want to offer building materials or things of that sort, you could call 503-791-9675. We also have accounts we set up for people who want to make cash donations at U.S. Bank and at Wana Federal Credit Union. The U.S. Bank, it's in the name of Columbia County Flood Relief, and U.S. Bank number is 429-6271, which is a good idea to call or have your local U.S. bank call them because it's hard to find that account. And Juana's number is 429-8031. Both of those are 503 area codes.
Well, Jim, I really appreciate you driving in to Portland to talk with us tonight. I know that this was on the minds of a lot of us in December, but I think once when the floodwaters recede, the problem doesn't end. And I know you were telling me initially this is years and years to cover.
The last time we were working 2 years into this before we decided that was enough. And I expect it'll be the same this time. And we appreciate all the help we can get, and thank you for the opportunity.
Well, best of luck, and we'll continue to update our listeners as time goes on. So we're going to close the show tonight. This is January, which is the month, of course, that we celebrate Dr. Martin Luther King. And we're going to close. We've had some heavy subjects tonight, and so we're going to hear some inspiring words, I guess words about actually looking at some of the dynamics that hold us back. So if I can get that cue in the studio, Mr. Engineer. All right. So this has been KBOO, and this is Dr. Martin Luther King from the Drum Major Instinct.
Always try to do a little converting when I'm in jail. And when we were in jail in Birmingham the other day, the white wardens and all enjoyed coming around the cell to talk about the race problem. And they were showing us where we were so wrong demonstrating, and they were showing us where segregation was so right. And they were showing us where intermarriage was so wrong. So I would get to preaching, and we would get to talking calmly because they wanted to talk about it. And then we got down one day to the point, that was the second or third day, to talk about where they lived and how much they were earning. And when those brothers told me what they were earning, I said, now, you know what? You ought to be marching with us. You just as poor as Negro. And I said, you are put in the position of supporting your oppressor because through prejudice and blindness, you fail to see that the same forces that oppress Negroes in American society oppress poor white people. Yes. And all you are living on is the satisfaction of your skin being white and the drum major instinct of thinking that you are somebody big because you're white and you're so poor you can't send your children to school. You ought to be out here marching with every one of us every time we have a march. Now that's the fact that the poor white has been put into this position where through blindness and prejudice he is forced to support his oppressors, and the only thing he has going for him is the false feeling that he's superior because his skin is white and can hardly eat and make his ends meet week in and week out. But let me rush on to my conclusion because I want you to see what Jesus was...
This is KBOO Portland.
Hi, I'm J.J. Johnson, host of Jay's Place on KBOO Radio. I would like to invite you to my annual Martin Luther King special, Monday.